Okay, when you're ready.
Griffith University Oral History, interview with Mr. John Topley on May the 13th, 1993. Mr. Topley, you were at the University of Queensland when the possibility of a new university in Brisbane was mooted. What was the first you heard of this idea?
There was discussion at high management levels in the University of Queensland and in the University of Queensland Senate. And I heard about it and was involved in discussions because I was at that time personal assistant to the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Queensland.
I see. And why was the University of Queensland and the University of Queensland Senate involved in the idea?
They felt that because they could see increasing demand for undergraduate university places in the immediate future, that there would need to be another campus of the University of Queensland. In those days, they didn't think that the university should be allowed to grow much larger than it was. They didn't then think of universities as being the size that they now are.
I see. And so, actually, Griffith was grew from a thought in the mind of University of Queensland as a second campus for U of Q.
Yes, they used to refer to it as the Mount Gravatt campus.
Oh, I see.
Or the Mount Gravatt University College of the University of Queensland.
And it was the idea of people at the University of Queensland, not the Queensland government of the time.
I didn't ever hear that the idea had originated with the Queensland government.
I see. And what did you think about the suggestion of a Mount Gravatt campus of the University of Queensland?
I actually didn't think about it very much at all. It made very little impact on me.
You were involved in the discussion there.
Yes, only as an administrative officer assisting the Vice-Chancellor.
Oh, I see.
And it was seen almost entirely as a strategic move to relieve overcrowding at the St. Lucia campus. Oh. And no one had given much thought to it as having a different character from the University of Queensland. The University of Queensland was then a very self-satisfied university.
Mm-hmm.
It had only recently achieved respectable status in Australia.
Oh, really?
Well, Sir Fred Chanel, I think,
oh, yes,
is widely attributed with having brought the University of Queensland up to the standard of other Australian universities,
yes,
and to international recognition, because before that time, academic staff there had been very low paid. Many of the academics had graduated from Queensland University and then joined the staff, and it didn't have the international characteristics or the status of other universities.
No, I see.
And so it was very self-conscious about having achieved its new status and very conservative.
Yes.
Rather conservative in the English model, which I always felt was inappropriate to Australian conditions.
Sir Fred Chanel, of course, was a wonderful man. He and his wife, Dr. Eleanor Chanel, they did a tremendous amount for University of Queensland.
Yes,
and for education in general in Queensland.
Yes, that's true. I was quite thrilled to be appointed as his personal assistant.
Yes, I'm sure you would.
And learnt a great deal from him, from working closely with him.
And then you went on to become personal assistant to Sir Zelman Cairns?
Well, in a sense, he inherited me as his personal assistant.
I see.
After Professor Hartley Teakle had occupied the Vice-Chancellorship during an interregnum.
Yes. And how did your association with Griffith begin?
It began just prior to Christmas 1970 when I received a phone call from Mr. William Wood,
nice,
then chair of the Board of Advanced Education,
yes,
I think,
yes,
who knew me from a previous association when I had been in charge of the Maryborough Opportunity School and he had been the Director of Special Education.
Yes.
He rang me and asked me if I'd be interested in being the administrative secretary of a planning committee to establish a new university. He told me I wasn't to tell anyone about it because the government hadn't made up its mind what it was going to do.
I see.
But not to be surprised if I received a phone call in January from a person he couldn't name who would be the chair of a planning committee.
I see. Well, this is a sort of a leading question. Did you know that Sir Theodore Bray... Did you know Sir Theodore Bray prior to coming to Griffith?
Not directly. I'd known his name for a long time because he was a close friend of a family that I'd known well in Townsville when I was a boy.
Ah, goodness.
And they spoke of him with great regard and affection.
Uh-huh.
That was the Hopkins family, and the wife was Joan Q.
Oh,
and
yes.
She knew the Brays very well.
Yes, she was Joan Hopkins.
Joan Hopkins,
yes.
Who had been Joan Q.
Yes, I see.
Her
yes.
husband was an Anglican minister
yes.
in Brisbane.
Yes, yes, I knew Joan.
Really?
Well.
So I knew the sons and daughters of the Hopkins family, having taken out the daughters and taught the son.
I see.
So I knew Ted Bray from that angle.
Yes.
And I also knew that he was editor-in-chief of the Courier-Mail, I think, at that time.
Mm. What were your duties when you first became part of the committee that Sir Theodore chaired? And were you rung up and told that Sir Theodore was the person who was going to chair the committee?
No, I received a phone call from him.
Oh.
And he said that he thought I had been approached and
mm-hmm.
was I interested in doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
And I said I was, because I'd spent my time as PA to the VC there researching the literature of higher education worldwide.
Right.
And I've always been interested in organisation of education. So
yeah.
To me this was a heaven-sent opportunity to pursue a line of work that I was really centrally interested in.
Oh, that's great.
So he said, was I interested? And I said, I was. He said, we'd better meet. Are you free for lunch tomorrow? Come to the Queensland Club, where I had never been, and press the brass bell.
I see.
So I did that.
And what was the position you occupied then? It was on the committee as...
It was the secretary to the committee, and I was seconded by Professor Zelman Cowan for a two-year period to act as secretary.
I see. So there was still an influence of the University of Queensland in that they were helping the new university or the new university college. Was it then to be a new university, or was it still to be a university college or campus attached to University of Queensland? Do you remember?
By that time, the government had decided it would be a separate university,
but it
would be built on the Mount Gravatt site.
Uh-huh.
There were lots of proposals for it to be built elsewhere,
uh-huh.
including a proposal from a firm of management consultants that it should be built over the Roma Street railway station, a very early use of space. And in retrospect, that would have been, I think, a far better arrangement than bringing it to its present site.
We wouldn't have had to worry about cutting down trees, would we, or BPOs?
Certainly not. But it would have avoided the problem of isolation and lack of recognition physically,
yes.
which I think is... something we suffer from very much even today. Would have been much more recognised.
Yes. The point now being, of course, with the establishment of the Queensland Conservatorium of Music on the South Bank, and therefore a face of Griffith to the town, to the city, this lack of recognition, you know, will be perhaps overcome. Well, it has been overcome in many ways anyway, hasn't it?
Yes. I think the difficulty at the moment, though, is that unlike the University of Queensland and QUT, people driving all around Griffith University can see very little evidence of a substantial physical presence.
Yes, yes.
But that would have been avoided had we gone to Roma Street, but that's water under the bridge.
Yes, it's amazing the number of things that have been mooted to be built over the railway yards at
yes,
Roma
yes,
Street.
Yes. Mm.
Now, what did your duties as secretary of the committee involve?
I worked very closely with then Mr. Bray
mm-hmm.
As the chair, and he worked full-time, energetically. He has a very eager and enthusiastic and dutiful personality, and he worked full-time, and so did I. And my duties were really to work in close support of him. I did the normal administrative secretarial work, which means preparing papers, position policy papers,
mm-hmm.
Working with him to make suggestions, helping brief other members of the planning council about things they might do to contribute to the conceptual process of planning, and generally to help steer the policy and planning within the committee. I also ran the office. We gradually acquired a little staff,
mm-hmm.
developed the first budget, which I seem to remember was somewhere in the vicinity of $30,000 for the year, and negotiated some staff support and equipment and that sort of thing.
Mm.
We started off in the office next door to the Vice-Chancellor at the University of Queensland, which was very supportive to us.
Very nice.
And
yes.
We used to meet there daily and discuss what needed to be done. Mm-hmm. And he would go off and do his things, and I would do my things.
Mm-hmm.
He worked.
And that was then just you and Sir Theodore.
Yes, that's right.
Nobody else.
Nobody else.
No.
And then after a little while, we moved to offices which Sir Theodore had managed to obtain from us from his friend Sir Charles Barton, who was then Coordinator General of Queensland,
mm-hmm.
in the new offices. In the new executive building at 100 George Street. And Charlie Barton gave us a space in the corner of his three or four floors of that building.
Oh, that was very good.
Yes.
It's a handy, useful spot.
We had been offered space in the Board of Advanced Education premises, but Ted Bray always felt that we needed to establish an independent presence as soon as possible so that we didn't come under anyone else's influence or appear to be under anyone else's influence.
The Board of Advanced Education, of course, had a very strong influence over the colleges of advanced education, or as they were at that stage, possibly still teachers' colleges.
Yes, or institutes of technology, some of them.
Yes,
such as at
Darling
Downs.
Yes,
it was generally felt that
the university should be independent.
Yes, that's correct.
Right from the beginning.
Mm.
And where did you go from the 100 George Street? Where was the next move to?
Well, during the course of that year, we appointed Roger Johnson.
This was 71.
1971, yes.
Mm-hmm.
We appointed Roger Johnson as our site planner,
mm-hmm.
and also appointed a vice-chancellor, Professor John Willett from the University of Melbourne,
mm-hmm.
who took up office early in 1972.
Mm-hmm.
During the course of 71, I suppose one of the things in which I was influential was suggesting to Ted Bray the main lines of activity that the Planning Council ought to undertake in order to get together the various elements of the university, including academic planning and separately organisational planning, and the preparation of legislation, and financial planning,
mm-hmm.
and physical planning,
mm-hmm.
and again, planning for the students of the university, which was something that wasn't much done then, so that the students had an input into of their feelings and aspirations about what universities ought to do for students.
And mm-hmm.
this wasn't very much done.
No.
And we also had a committee looking at the needs of part-time students who were very much neglected
mm-hmm.
at that era. And I suppose if I wanted to be boastful about anything, I would take pride in having been influential in getting work done along those lines, so that in the end we progressed our planning in an integrated way, but very much based on what sort of academic philosophy we wanted to have.
How did you must have involved quite a lot of people then with these separate committees. Were they little committees?
Yes, they were fairly small.
Four or five or three or four?
Not more than that. Good size for committees.
Yes.
There were, I think, 11 or 12, I can't remember precisely, people on the planning committee, which later became the interim council.
And am I right that you were lent some students from the University of Queensland?
Yes, well, I suppose the students felt they'd volunteered, but they came to us from there.
Mm-hmm.
And we involved people from outside. We had core members of the committee from the planning committee,
mm-hmm.
the subcommittees, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And we drew on other people as well to join us. But the real academic philosophy was nutted out in the planning committee itself, and key players there were Professor Peter Mason from Macquarie University.
Oh yes, I've heard.
Professor Steve Lipton from University of Queensland. Professor Campbell, who was Dean of Education at the University of Queensland. And I'm forgetting someone, and that's a bad thing to do. Professor Val Presley, of course.
Val Presley, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And they were very central to...
Val Presley was U of Q too?
Yes, he was Professor of Philosophy at the University of Queensland.
Yes.
They were very central. And Ted Bray himself had lots of ideas. He was very keen to promote Australia's relations with Asia, for example.
Yes.
And wanted Asian languages taught in the university.
Yeah.
Indeed, one of the first things he did was to instruct me to arrange for us to visit the vice-chancellors of some of Australia's newer universities. And I got to know him quite well on that journey because he dragged me off, as it were, around Eastern Australia to visit universities, particularly he wanted to talk to La Trobe and Flinders University. And we did pay other visits, but Flinders was eventually the most influential.
Was it really?
Yes, well, Peter Carmel was Vice-Chancellor then, and he had only just been appointed chair of, I think it was then the University's Council, or the, whatever the federal body was then called. We also visited the University's Council, which was chaired at that stage by Sir Henry Baston, who had come from Adelaide himself, I think. So, but Carmel was the person who was most persuasive and most cogent in the way he was able to describe his own philosophy in the creation of Flinders University. And the process was that we would meet people during the day, chancellors, vice-chancellors and others, and I would at night dictate my recollections of the day's events.
And then you'd go into it again the next day.
Yes, and so that paper, and Ted Bray took his own shorthand notes, and we combined our efforts, and that was probably one of the first papers that went to the planning committee.
Who would you say was most influential in creating the ethos? Is it? I mean, you talked of two professors of philosophy. Were they the ones who created the ethos, or was it? Well, let's say more practical attitude to the new ideas of education that Griffith was to present?
No, that was by no means confined to the professors. There was a strong feeling among the other members of the committee that universities had become out of touch and weren't necessarily providing what the community needed.
The old ivory tower syndrome.
Yes, quite. And there was a lot of pressure that this shouldn't be allowed to happen at Griffith. I don't think anyone actually created the ethos, Patience. I think it emerged from a number of lines of thinking. The committee itself had developed the notion about our academic approach, that it should be an integrated approach and not divided into disciplines. That it should be an approach which related what students learnt in the university in some way to a student perception that there would be a real-world outcome of what they were studying. Sometimes that's represented as the simple idea of relating it to the real world, but it was more so that students could understand that what they were studying really meant something, and that that would be best done in an integrated way. Peter Mason was particularly strong on this, and so was Val Presley, that we ought to break down the disciplinary boundaries and focus on academic themes or problems, and then bring behind that study whatever academic resources were needed. So that was one main force.
You hear problem solving tossed around a great deal these days, even by parliamentarians. And this was something that was applied as far as Griffith was concerned right from the beginning.
Yes.
And nobody was ever was talking about it at that stage, as far as I can recall.
No, and of course the meaning of problem was special for us. It incorporated that idea that students needed to see that what they were doing had some sort of an application.
Had a relevance.
Yes, a relevance, and that word was used a lot. But it also meant that the problems were properly conceptually and intellectually formed. It wasn't a problem such as, oh dear, part of my house has fallen off, what will I do about it? It was a problem of the sort, Australia is sitting out here in this part of the world, and here are a lot of different nations which are collectively known as Asia. The problem was, what should Australia be doing about learning about Asia and relating to it?
And they should they be learning about us,
yes,
too?
And that was the problem. And
yes,
then
I see.
We brought the intellectual and academic resources together to deal with a problem defined in that way.
Yes. And then the other unique school, of course, at Griffith in those days was Australian Environmental Sciences, Australian Environmental Studies, as it was called in the beginning. Did you go the same way there with the problem-solving idea?
Yes, we had trouble actually working out what that school would be. And I'd just like to go back to the, your previous question for a minute, if I may, about ethos. Because the other component of the ethos, there are two others really. One was that students should have a special relationship with their staff. And therefore, instead of adopting the smorgasbord approach that the University of Queensland and other traditional universities had, where students visited departments to learn about certain things, that we would try to create an organisational structure where students had contact with a limited range of academic staff and got to know them well, and worked in a relatively small cohesive unit, which we then call schools, so that they wouldn't be darting about all over the university, but would have a cohesive course. So the other part of the ethos was there'd be far less choice for students. That was quite a deliberate decision early in the university. Far less subject choice than was traditional. Mm-hmm. And that was necessary, we felt, because of the attempt to be interdisciplinary.
Mm-hmm.
The third part of the ethos development was a wish to treat people in a different way. And John Willett deserves a great deal of credit for most of what I've just been talking about, the development of it. I mean, he was a real dynamo mm-hmm. in the creation of the university.
Mm-hmm.
But also in bringing about organisational structures and behaviour by the early staff of the university, which was designed to be much more respectful of other people, whether they be students or not. He was a very rigorous man, and sometimes people felt he was brutal. I sometimes felt that too. But I think he was driven by the wish to get things right.
Mm.
And he had a good questioning mind and a capacity to integrate in a very systematic way that lots of academics don't.
Yes.
And so he, in a sense, integrated that all those factors I've been talking about into the Griffith ethos. Sorry for that long-winded question,
no,
but it's not a simple matter.
No, it's not. It never has been. And it's puzzled a lot of people.
Mm.
But I'm interested in the smallness of the group idea, because that's the sort of thing I was hearing when I first came to Griffith. I'd meet someone who had been a student at University of Queensland and had come to Griffith, and they said at the University of Queensland they had felt as though they were just a cog in a machine, whereas here they felt that someone cared about them, was interested in them, and they could talk to people.
We deliberately set out to do that.
Mm.
But we had one, I think, very substantial failure in our operations, and that was that we didn't, when we recruited new staff, pay enough attention to socialising those people into the culture of Griffith University. My private feeling about that is that it's such a strong taboo in the academic elite to actually try to instruct other people how to behave,
mm-hmm.
that the university couldn't bring itself to take the steps to try to socialise the new members of the tribe into the tribal culture.
Mm-hmm.
We started off doing that in selection processes by getting people to write about the notion of the dynamics of Griffith rather than just saying how good they were at physics.
Mm-hmm.
But that dropped by the wayside, and I think for much the same reason, that academics felt embarrassed about asking other academics to do that sort of thing. And I think that was a failure of the early university to provide the mechanism to have the culture survive at least long enough to be tested properly.
Mm. That's interesting, because I recall a lecturer, when I arrived at a tutorial, and I was apologising profusely for the non-attendance of another student. And he said, doesn't matter, he can come if he wants to, he doesn't have to come if he doesn't want to.
Mm.
And this was getting away from the school idea of, you know, you must do this or you must do that. I wondered at first whether it was a pity, because, you know, I would see some students having great fun right on the top floor of what was then the library building, when I felt they should have been at a tutorial. But it seemed to work, because a lot of them went on to get PhDs.
Well,
and probably become very well-rounded people too.
As a former teacher, I suppose I can say I believe there's some truth in the fact that teachers often impede rather than assist education,
mm-hmm.
and that students can often do quite well themselves.
When did you first set foot on the Nathan campus?
Very soon after the planning committee was established, we paid a site visit here.
There were no roads then?
Yes, there were.
Oh, there were?
Yes, the whole ring road was by then constructed.
Ah, now who was responsible for doing that?
The University of Queensland had been responsible for causing it to happen I think, 3, 4, or 5 years before we took over the site. It had been done with Commonwealth money. I think I seem to remember a figure of $200,000 in those days. The work had been done by the Coordinator General's Department. I think Sid Schubert, who later became Coordinator General, had a hand in it.
I recall Lady Holt telling me that she sat in a car, and which is now somewhere, which was then near where the cemetery now is, while her husband, who was then Coordinator General, forgotten his first name, but anyway, he was then Coordinator General, while he walked all over the site to decide whether or not it would be a good one.
Yes, well, Sid Schubert worked in the Coordinator General's Department then, under Charlie Barton. And the Ring Road was as a result of a plan developed by James Birrell, who was then the university architect of the who was at that time that the road was built, university architect of the University of Queensland. And the University of Queensland and James Birrell had built a ring road similar to the one that then encircled the St Lucia campus.
Ah, yes, around the original central.
Yes. So there were those roadworks on the site. And though, as described by Ted Bray, like a four-lane highway through the bush. And it gave us great problems later because it became a speedway, quite unsuitable for the sort of university plan we eventually adopted, which really ignored the ring road and was impeded by it.
Yes, yes. And when did the first buildings go up?
The planning we had the leisure of 4 years of planning before Griffith was required to open.
And you moved from various spots? I mean, you went to George Street. Well, where was the next move to?
Yes. I'll just go back to your previous question,
if I may.
And so the planning was able to go on in a sequence which fed through academic planning and then organisational, financial and space planning after we knew what we wanted to do. For example, the space planning was affected very much by the wish to have separately identifiable schools rather than a lot of departments. So that meant different scales and different relationships. So that was worked out before the space planning began. So Roger Johnson...
Who worked that out?
The committee itself.
I see.
Then Roger Johnson came on board at the end of 1971, and he and John Willett were particularly instrumental in putting the space notions together. So Roger Johnson then did a site plan, which abandoned the Ring Road, and was focused on a fairly dense concentration around a central pedestrian spine with major functional space elements emptying onto that spine. And the university rejected the notion of scattering itself around in the bush and came to be a concentrated university. So the first building that was built was in fact the squash courts down at the bottom of what is now Griffith Road, to be the headquarters of the site planning division of the university,
so
they could be on site.
I see.
And I seem to remember that
they weren't used as squash courts then.
No, but they were designed to be used as squash courts.
I see.
And the site, the planning division went into there, I rather suspect, around the end of 1972. I can't remember precisely.
And from there, you did the committee meet there as well?
No.
Or only the site planning committee?
Only the site planning.
Well, where did the committee then go on to meet?
The committee had become the interim council of the university for a while, and our headquarters moved from George Street out to offices in Sherwood Road, Toowong.
Ah, yes.
Where we stayed, I think, for about 18 months or 2 years. Then we moved to a commercial building in Evans Road, Salisbury.
Ah, yes, I've heard of that.
And the library was in a nearby building in Precision Street, Salisbury.
You were buying books or...
Collecting books.
Collecting books.
The then librarian, Sid Page, was rather disturbed that we'd had a public appeal for people to give us books. I think he ended up with about 16 or 20 copies of Tom Brown's School Days. And that was prior to 1974 and the big flood. And the Precision Street buildings, which housed the library collection, were threatened by the flood. And Sid said that he wasn't sure whether he wanted the flood to get the books because so much rubbish had been donated, or not to get the books so as to protect the little bit of good stuff that he had.
Sounds typical of him. And you say you stayed there, actually, until you came on site?
Yes, we stayed there until the end of 1974.
Mm. Just a year before teaching began.
Well, months before teaching began.
Oh, months before, yes.
Yes. And the move to here occurred at the end of 74, early 75.
And what buildings were there then on site?
The science building,
mm-hmm.
and the humanities building,
mm-hmm.
and the library building were the three, I think. Yes, I think they were the first three. Robin Gibson did the library humanities building.
Mm-hmm.
Blair Wilson did the science building. Oh, and there was the university house.
That
which was designed by John Dalton.
Oh, yes, that was one of the early ones,
yes,
too.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we started with, apart from the squash courts down at the bottom of the hill.
Griffith has, from the beginning, been different from the University of Queensland, hasn't it?
Yes.
And I think probably you've told us the ways in which you think it was different.
Yes.
Are there any other particular ways? There was one thing that struck me as quite strange, and that was, you know, I'd always had a great respect for authority. Editors were always Mr. Bray or Sir Theodore, and professors were always Professor so-and-so. And I came to Griffith and found everybody was calling everybody by their first names.
Yes, that wasn't a University of Queensland characteristic.
It wasn't, no.
No. I think...
Is it a good thing or a bad thing, do you think?
I think it's quite a good thing. It's even a better thing these days. Because I think young people are rather more socially mature than they were even when Griffith started, and capable of dealing with people on first-name terms without losing respect.
Yes.
The main thing I'd like to say about that patience is that Griffith deliberately set out to be different, led very much by John Willett, who took the view that Monash, by trying to be like the University of Melbourne, had impeded its development by 10 or 15 years, because it obviously wouldn't be able to compete with a university like Melbourne. So he took the marketing view that there was another need developing among the university's clients, a need for, not for a conservative approach that the University of Queensland had and other traditional Australian universities, but for an approach that was preparing people for the 21st century.
Mm.
I find it interesting that those early views, which were shared by everyone, now emerge as the proper indicated market approach for the university, even though it's gone through quite a lot of change on the way.
Yes, yes. It's funny sometimes that, you know, things are done today and done by people who don't really realise that some of this, you know, started way, way back.
Yes. Well,
it doesn't do any harm, of course, except as long as you don't go on reinventing the wheel.
Yes, well, I think the wheel's been rediscovered a number of times in the last 22 years.
Was there any liaison between University of Princeton and Griffith?
Yes, a very close working relationship.
Yes, that's nice, isn't it?
And Zelman Cowan and John Willett. Zelman Cowan and John Willett worked very hard personally to keep that relationship happy and constructive. It was one of the triumphs of their relationship.
Yes.
And they both, I thought, did a very good job for Queensland and the universities doing that. Some of us on the staff of the university had come from the U of Q, and therefore we had networks.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the benediction, I suppose, offered over the operation by both the vice-chancellors, no one felt reluctant about cooperation or asking for something or ringing someone else.
No,
that happened
that
both ways. And we used to cooperate in planning and mostly a one-way trade from the University of Queensland to us.
Actually, Sir Zelman Cowan has gone on being a tremendous friend to the university,
hasn't he? Right until the present day.
Yes, right up to the his help in establishing the law school.
Of course, Zelman had come into the University of Queensland hoping to reform it,
I
think being a bit disappointed in that. The University of Queensland was an exceptionally reactionary university,
really,
with God professors very much calling the tune, and it was a tough row for a Vice-Chancellor to hoe.
You were a very important figure in the setting up of the administration of the new university. Now, you've told us about the development of the ethos. How did you go about the development of the administrative system, and was that in any way different from the University of Queensland?
Yes, it was different. It's nice of you to say I was important, but we need to recognise that John Willett was a former professor of business management and something of an organisational sociologist. My interests were in much the same area, so he was very influential too, and we worked fairly much to the same sort of music, which was a very happy thing because we had similar ideas. And I have to say how much I learnt from him and his wisdom and insight about organisations. I think it's one of the things that I remember him very fondly for. So I suppose my interest was looking at the early legislation and the development of statutes and trying to apply principles that he and I both had about how management ought to work, and that was to diminish the vertical level, the vertical distance in management, by diminishing the number of levels of hierarchy, to distribute authority and responsibility. Some managements make the mistake of trying to distribute responsibility without giving people authority to act, and others do it the other way around. So we wanted to do that, and that meant that permission giving and authority to act had to go out with responsibility out to the operational elements of the university, and it meant that the centre was concerned principally with setting down policies and principles, allocating resources, letting people get on, and but setting up a strong audit mechanism, not financial audit, but the capacity to audit what was happening. And I think we developed that structure, but it's actually a fairly sophisticated and complex structure. And it fell into disuse after some time, after John Willett left, actually.
One of the, to go back to the financial side, was it something new that schools, as they then were given responsibility for their own budget? They, I imagine, said what they wanted to the when the time for submissions to the Vice-Chancellor came in, and then the allocations were made to the schools, and the schools then managed their own affairs. They had their own administrator, and they looked after both the academic, their academic staff, and their administrative staff. And this has continued now onto the when we have schools within faculties.
Yes, well, it was something of a novelty, but not entirely novel. In 1972, I visited some universities in the US. And they were working that way, and John Willett had been instrumental in getting some devolution of authority and responsibility and financial control in the University of Melbourne before coming here. But it wasn't very widely done. One of the administrative innovations here was to put the general staff into the schools rather than have them controlled by the central offices. And that was to reinforce the notion that they had the authority and responsibility there. I don't think in the end that was really a very sensible idea.
Did it create a sort of
isolation? Too much tension. It created a lot of tension. But by the same token, I'm not sure that an entirely centralised system works either, so I'm a bit unresolved about that.
Yes.
The idea, though, of combining in the chairman of the school, that is what we now call dean, mm-hmm. the management responsibility, the academic responsibility and the financial responsibility was quite an innovation, because in traditional universities the academic responsibility lay with the dean of a faculty and the financial responsibility lay with the head of a department.
Mm.
So it was separated, but here it was combined, making the chairs very powerful positions.
Mm. Has that worked?
I think it has. I think it's made it a much more flexible university.
Mm. Oh, that's great. What were some of the difficulties you experienced in the early days? Some of them.
I can't remember too many.
Oh, that's great.
We all worked very long hours, mm-hmm. and we were probably a bit more earnest and anxious about things than we should have been. The Queensland government was a bit impeding in one respect early on, and it was, for example, they didn't want us to buy an electric typewriter. They wanted us to buy a manual typewriter, and that was dealt with very quickly by Sir Theodore. On the other hand, they were very helpful. Alan Sewell, who was then Auditor General, and on our finance committee and on the planning committee, guided us, and me particularly, as a very young and inexperienced administrator, through some pitfalls, and he helped to ease the way with readjusting budget amounts in Brisbane and in Canberra so that we could use our budgets most effectively, doing things that I didn't know how to do.
I know Sir Theodore has the most tremendous respect for Sir Alan Sewell. Of course, Sir Alan went on to become Chancellor.
Yes, and...
Or Deputy Chancellor first.
Yes, he helped
a
great deal. What were the difficulties we faced?
Was it the opening, the first day of teaching? Did that all go well, or were there some problems?
Yes, it went well. I suppose one of the difficulties, which was faced very much more by John Willett than me, and by the business manager, Kev C, and Roger Johnson by then, the site and buildings manager, was that the major contractor went under a few months before we were due to occupy the library and manager's building. And John Willett, in his typical forthright management style, guaranteed the subcontractors they would be paid, and the senior officers of the university should line up on Friday afternoons and receive the invoices and the certifications from the clerks of works and dole out the money to the subbies so that they would stay on the job. Because, as you know, they're very vulnerable when the head contractor goes under.
You see it happen over and over again, don't you? Well, what were some of the great successes? I mean, that would have been in itself one of the great successes.
It was
John
indeed.
Would have managed to get them to stay on and worked out some way in which they could be looked after. But what do you regard as some of the other great successes over the years?
I think we've made some quite good appointments to the staff of the university. Particularly in the early years, we tended to attract people who were thinking laterally and thinking innovatively about academic matters and academic teaching. And I think we established some very good practices there.
Mm-hmm.
The approach to providing larger studies for academic staff so that they could provide tutorials in their own rooms rather than go elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But those practices have disappeared now when...
The purse tightened.
Yeah, quite so.
Griffith began teaching in the new era of free tertiary education, didn't it?
Yes.
Was that an advantage to a university just beginning?
Not as much as I think some of the advocates of the system then thought. And in the end, I think it has been a real disadvantage to universities, because prior to Griffith's opening, the cost of undergraduate education was shared one part by the Commonwealth, about 0.85, not quite right, but it's about that figure, by the state, and about 0.15 by the individual student. And many students were indirectly supported through the Commonwealth, through the then Commonwealth Scholarship Scheme.
Mm-hmm.
The impact of bringing the cost of higher education into one parliament was that for the first time the citizens of Australia saw the bottom line cost of higher education, and it placed on the Commonwealth Parliament the sole burden of providing the money. Mm-hmm. So it became a big budget item, mm-hmm. which attracted the raisers when budgets needed to be slashed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The other side of it was that when the states had a real financial stake in their higher education institution, they used to take them much more seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And quite often a university could rely on the full strength of a state's political structure to help it bargain with Canberra. I don't think there's really anything like that strength of support and relationship. I can remember, for example, a story which I had second hand, so it'd have to be taken in that light, of Zelman Cowan going into the state government to beg for $1 million for the library, and a comment by one of our senior politicians, I'm not sure whether it was Joe Jockey Peterson or Gordon Chalk at the time, how many books have you got in the library? And he was told, and he said, well, why don't they read the books they've already got? But I'm told that we came home with $1 million. So that just showed that there was a special relationship that could be used to the advantage of the university.
Excuse me, Mr. Toms, I'll need to change the table.
Right here.
Brad?
Yes,
you could wave to us.
Did you fear Griffith's ability to survive when the higher education contribution charges were introduced?
No.
Good. Why?
I thought that people would value higher education enough to want to have it. And I don't think that it has had much of an impact. There was lots of doctrinaire and political discussion about how it might upset the balance of access to higher education. But in terms of bottom line figures, I don't think it had too much impact.
Just in passing, do you think that we are now allowed to take full fee-paying overseas students? Do you think we ought to be allowed to take Australian full fee-paying students?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think we need to have a scheme which protects the ability of people in all circumstances to have access to higher education. And that requires making judgments about who should get help and who doesn't need to have help.
Yes.
And we know that bureaucracies aren't very good at making those sorts of judgments. But the question of being able to pay a certain amount towards higher education, or even the full fee, is only one of many factors which decide on whether a person goes to university.
It's not going to mean that standards would be lowered anyway.
Well, I don't know. What are standards?
The ability to make the best possible use of a university education.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Mm.
I think, too, that people now have so many opportunities throughout their lives to go in and out of all sorts of post-secondary education that the idea of a separate university education is diminishing, and indeed the moves that are now underway to recognise associate diplomas done in TAFE, to recognise industry-based training, to recognise life experience for credit in universities, breaks down a lot of those rigid tracks or...
In other words, education is the important thing.
Yes, and indeed, many students who can't get into universities, I think, are now finding they don't need to have immediate post-secondary higher education.
No. John, Griffith was welcomed to the Association of Higher Education Administrators, wasn't it? And I seem to remember that you played a significant role in the association. There was a conference at Griffith, wasn't there, in the 1980s?
Yes.
And you were one of the...
Well, I became the national president of that
young
body.
Did you?
It's the Australian Institute of Tertiary Education Administrators.
Tertiary Education Administrators, yes.
And I was its third national president for a period of 4 years and had been the state president for 2 years.
Hmm.
So, yes, I think... I can't say that I played a significant role in that.
All right, that's very good indeed. Remembering Griffith in its early days and looking at it now.
Hello, excuse me, Ms. Thomas.
Yeah.
We've got a message from Trish Francis.
Yes, just a sec. Can you hear me?
What was all that?
A message for you from Trish Francis.
Yes, remembering Griffith in the early days and looking at it now, how do you express your feelings? How would you express your feelings?
Well, the scale of the university means that it's quite a different place. At last, it seems to be fully populated. There were years and years and years when the students seemed to rattle around in the spaces. So one of the changes is that it's very populated, and my feeling about that is that that's a nice thing. It's really a pleasure to walk about on a crowded campus.
Walking down the spine path today, masses of students coming up towards me, and I thought, oh, this is great.
I think we've lost a lot of our vigour, and I think we've lost a lot of our administrative excellence. I think we're an administratively excellent university, and certainly we were only planned for our administrative and organisational structures to be a university of 8,000. We're well beyond that now. Mm. But I do regret that we weren't able to translate some of the quite innovative and workable administrative and managerial principles that were applied in the early days into the new scale of university. But on the other hand, that's a massive task, and maybe I'm too idealistic about it.
It's not a question of having become middle-aged, is it? In, you know, quote, middle-aged, unquote. Sort of the younger people who started off the university.
I'm sure that there's been a decline in vigour, speaking for myself and others, I suppose. But I also think that we've just acquired a different philosophy about what we value in the university. The scale of values of the university has changed a great deal.
Not for the better, you feel?
Not according to my ideals. I don't think... I think we have devalued interdisciplinarity. I think we've devalued the problem-oriented or theme approach.
Do you really?
I think we've increased our values attracted to the more conservative aspects of academic organisation. And I think we have decreased the amount of care we give to our staff and our students as a university as a whole. So I find that a little bit disappointing. But again, it might be a function of scale.
The other thing, perhaps when I was first associated with the university, there was not the adversarial situation between unions, staff unions, and employers, which has now developed, not, I should say, due to the administrators of the university's desire, but, you know, largely because they had to form an association to talk to the unions. Yes. And it seems to me a little bit of a pity. It seems that we've lost some of the ability to get round and talk with people and sort it out at a local level.
Yes, well, I was part of the administrative team that I'm now criticising, so it's not a criticism of others.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, in retrospect, we probably allowed ourselves as a university management to be too influenced by the adversarial nature of industrial relations and drew away from talking with our staff.
Mm-hmm.
Because I noticed the staff haven't, in fact, drawn away from the university. There's a very low incidence of union activity, for example, among the general staff. Many still look to the university to be the benign, caring, perhaps paternal management that, or maternal management.
Mm, thank you.
that was traditional in universities. And I think there's quite a gap that you rightly identify in that brought about by that reaction to the adversarial nature of industrial relations. And that's part of my concern, that we're not really as caring about our staff as we once were.
It exists everywhere, though, doesn't it? It's one of the great challenges of people teaching in the area of industrial relations, to try and overcome this adversarial atmosphere.
Mm, yes. Mm. I think we could perhaps do a bit more about it.
Who were some of the great personalities at Griffith over the past 18 years? In the academic and the business sector?
Well, Ted Bray, without a doubt. Mm-hmm. I think he would have to be, in my mind, the most outstanding character. He is a bit of a devil and likes to poke sleeping dogs with sticks, but also likes to get things done.
Yes.
I remember the first conversation I ever had with him. He said to me, "Well, Mr. Topley, you know I'm a newspaper man, and in the newspaper world we have just 24 hours to make each set of decisions. Let's keep it that way." And he's always been like that, but I regard him very highly, and I think, as you know, with an enormous amount of affection.
Mm.
We're still friends, and we have lunch together every so often.
I know he regards you very highly, too.
Thank you. So I think Alan Sewell is another great figure. Val Presley was one of the great figures.
John Willett, of course.
Oh, absolutely, yes, John Willett.
And Jeannie Willett.
Yes, John Willett always used to say this is a four-handed job, and he was always thinking of Jean when he said that, and she made an enormous contribution. They sacrificed a great deal of their personal lives in order to make their home the place where people visiting for selection had dinners with selection committees, where the staff got together every so often. They worked very hard to bond people into the university. Yes, he was a great character. Roger Johnson, the site planner, was a remarkably insightful man.
I've always thoroughly enjoyed his site planning reviews, but never met him.
Oh,
and
really?
I didn't ever realise that he was on site. I thought he came up from Sydney or somewhere.
And he was our first permanent appointment.
And he was on site?
Yes.
Oh.
And
then after some years then that he...
After a few years, when we got more into the structural and less into the planning stage, he moved on to the then Canberra CAE to head its design faculty or department, which I think was more to his taste than having to deal with contractors. Who else were the great characters? Kev C., the business manager, was a great character. Colin Phillips, our first curator of grounds, was a character in his own way. He used to take on causes that upset some of our academics. He was very anti-fluoridation, for example.
Oh, yes.
It used to irritate some of our scientists.
Sir Theodore's too, I think.
Was he?
I think he
might have been a secret fellow traveller of Colin Phillips. I mentioned Alan Sewell, I think. Len Butts, the first Deputy Chancellor.
Yes. Yes.
He came from the firm of Morris, Fletcher and Cross, and he guided us through a lot of our early legal and formal and business, not problems, but developments.
And are there any questions that I haven't asked you that you'd, is there anything that you'd like to sort of volunteer now about, looking at the history of Griffith, what it was, what it is, what it maybe should become?
Only to say that Griffith attracted quite a lot of positive reaction from people outside the university. I think it was regarded as being somewhat pinkish by Joe Jockey Peterson and his friends, but at the same time, I think we were the only university in Australia then to have an underground right-wing newspaper. So it's a bit hard to put into one set of ideas what the character of a university is.
Yes.
But we attracted a lot of positive support among teachers who could see happening here things that the more enlightened teachers wanted to have happen in schools.
Marvellous.
On the other hand, of course, there were conservative secondary school teachers who thought that the University of Queensland was the only way to do it. But Griffith, I don't think, ever has had the negative reputation that some think it has. On the other hand, the university of first choice for a lot of people has been the University of Queensland, and we're still battling that issue.
Tradition has a lot to do with that,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes, and the fact that you go to the University of Queensland to enter some of the more prestigious professions.
Yes, medicine, dentistry.
And certainly the present Vice-Chancellor has done well, I think, in trying to expand the range of Griffith's offerings. I think Roy Webb's, one of his big contributions to Griffith has been to broaden us into the clearly identified vocational areas. And in that respect, we're not in a bad situation at the moment, because we've got a range of clearly recognised vocational degrees and also a range of what I regard as the vocationally oriented general degrees. And it's interesting to see how the regard for generalist graduates has picked up over the last 5 years. So I think one of Roy Webb's great achievements has been to give us that rather balanced approach in the marketplace.
Oh, that's great. And also, of course, the problem of coping with a multi-campus organisation.
Yes.
That is one of the very difficult things, isn't it?
Yes. I don't think John Dawkins will be forgiven soon for what he's done to higher education.
Well, of course, it didn't start with Dawkins. It started with the Razor Gang.
Yes.
And the combining, the mashing together of colleges of advanced education, as they
were. Yes, you remember that particularly pungently, don't you?
Well, John, thank you very much indeed for doing this recording, and it will go into the records now as part of the history of Griffith.
That's a frightening prospect. Thank you,
Patience. Thank you. Well, is he still there?
No.
Oh, he's left us. Maybe none of that latter part got...
Well, I hope the recording machine is still going.
Yes, well, that's what I was wondering. But I'm sure he's never let me down.
No, I think he
the lights are still on there.
Nothing in and out for the course of the thing, so...
Yeah.